This is the Takeaway Podcast for Friday, June 19th, 2015. And I love this detail. It's Juneteenth. June 19th is Juneteenth, when African Americans commemorate the final end of slavery in America. This is the Takeaway, and it's Friday. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening. And what happened this week? What happened this week? I tweeted that only in America do you have in the same week a network anchor who lied and tells America he wants to be trusted, a woman who's white who tells America she wants to be considered black, and a white man with a gun who kills 9 black people in a church in Charleston and says to police he wants to start a race war. One week. But is it one America? Trust, race, and violence. All three of those. That's the big construct right there in one crazy, only in America kind of biblical parable. What does it mean? Is it terrorism in Charleston, people argue? No. Yes, of course it is. And the attacks on blacks that have happened throughout history, African Americans under siege, those were terrorism. Is it racial? Of course it is. Confederate flag flying over the State House in South Carolina? Hello? All-black church, hello, white guy with a gun who wears patches from white-ruled Rhodesia that were made long before he was born, hello? This year, gun violence, I love this statistic, is poised to surpass car deaths in America. Have you heard about that? No, of course you haven't. Race is dominating the conversation in our cities right now, cities filled with tension between African Americans and police. Can we trust each other in America? Huh? That's the tough one. Forget Al-Qaeda. Forget ISIS. We're doing this to ourselves. Can we trust ourselves to get this right anytime soon?
We gather to offer our condolences and to pray with and for the families of the friends, colleagues, and family members killed in a senseless, tragic episode of domestic terrorism.
They're working on trust there in Charleston. That's the Reverend Charles Watkins speaking to the people of Charleston and speaking for them at one of the many prayer vigils and memorial services in town. In whispered voices, these people move forward from the shooting on Wednesday night of 9 people, including the pastor, at a service at the Emmanuel African Methodist Episcopal Church in Charleston. How is the community doing? Bakari Sellers is a former South Carolina state representative. He knows many of the dead. And told us today in Charleston there are no ambiguities right now. And trust, he says he can see it, barely.
As you saw a community acknowledge what this was, it was a hate crime, it was an assault against individuals simply because of the color of their skin. And then they put together a plan to apprehend this individual in a very short amount of time. You have to take a step back and you have to acknowledge that this type of callous hatred, this type of racism, this type of domestic terrorism was handled in a fashion that must be applauded.
Positive. That's Bakari Sellers, former South Carolina state representative. He's feeling positive today, given everything that's going on. But what about race and violence and the pockets where shooter suspect Dylan Roth, now charged with 9 counts of murder, learned his hate? What about that? Where are those pockets? Who's watching those pockets? Can they even be watched until someone with a gun actually walks into the church and does what we saw? Joining me now with more is Heidi Byruck, who's head of the Intelligence Project at the Southern Poverty Law Center. Welcome back to The Takeaway, Heidi.
Thanks for having me.
So Heidi, how do you, I this quote has been haunting me all day, and apparently one of the friends of Dylan Roth said, oh yeah, sure, he was talking about violence and telling all these horrible racial jokes and using the N-word all the time, but I just thought he was kidding, that somehow that's normal. It doesn't necessarily mean you're going to do something. How do you do if you see something, say something in a place like that where it's normal to think that way? It must complicate your job.
Well, it's actually a little frightening, right, for someone to think that that kind of stuff would be normal, right? I'm not sure how that could be the case. And it's clear that from those comments that there were indications that this guy was going to do something violent at some point anyways. It's unfortunate no one spoke up. In fact, we found in a lot of cases with lone wolf actors like this, I mean, if it turns out he did this by himself, that they do actually broadcast whatever, you know, the object of their ire is, whatever their views are, and the idea that they're going to do something about it. People do need to speak up.
But let's not talk down to our presumptions about a culture of, you know, trailer people or people living in cabins out in the woods somewhere. I mean, how do these two communities live so close together and the intersections, as we saw on Wednesday night, become so bloody and there's no advance warning?
Yeah, well, unfortunately, it happens more than you would think. And you're right to make the point about not talking down. But at this point in time, you can live anywhere and with a keyboard, immerse yourself in the world of violent white supremacy, right? We don't know if Mr. Roth did or didn't do that, but it sure sounds like from the words that he spoke in that church that he had been spending a lot of time on sites like Stormfront.org or the Council of Conservative Citizens. These are big white supremacist outfits that talk about nothing except the fact that white people are being genocided by blacks. It's an outrageous notion, but that's the kind of propaganda that's being pumped out there. It doesn't matter where you are, you know, very quickly you can be in that world.
Now, the NSA, you know, we're led to believe is watching all of the conversations of people all over the world, you know, whenever Al-Qaeda comes up or jihad comes up. Do you have any sense that you are joined by investigators in the federal government in watching for people who are doing exactly as you say, looking at inflammatory websites about white supremacy and getting all stirred up by this idea that African-Americans are taking over?
Well, I don't think the federal government has done their job very well on this front. A few years ago, they shut down the Department of Homeland Security's unit that was dedicated to right-wing extremism. They did that under a firestorm of complaints from the right. The FBI can only look at this stuff if they have a criminal predicate. So the fact of the matter is that we have basically dens of lone wolves on these big white supremacist hate sites, and they're going unmonitored while at the same time the federal government is expending extreme resources to battle Islamic extremism. Now, you know, I'm not against battling Islamic extremism, but we've got our own domestic terrorism problem here in the U.S., and it involves whites, mostly white males, and it deserves as much attention as the other threats do.
And can you give me a sense of the numbers I was searching and trying to find? You know, since 9/11, it's something like 8 foreign attacks versus more than 300 a year of domestic attacks of one kind or another. But it was hard for me to categorize. You know this stuff back and forwards. Help me out here.
Yeah, the numbers are basically along the lines of what you said. A handful of jihadi attacks domestically, right, in the United States, and dozens and dozens and dozens of right-wing inspired, you know, attacks. In fact, in a report that we put out in February on lone wolf violence, we found that there has been an attempted plot or a carried out one by someone influenced either by white supremacist or radical anti-government beliefs every 34 days for the last 5 years. And I think most people don't really realize that this is going on. They don't understand that we have a domestic terrorism problem that's coming from white guys, basically, you know, influenced by extremist ideas. That is very, very serious. And that is unfortunate. And we just learned that lesson again in Charleston the other day.
All right. Help me out with two things here before we go. Number one, I'm going to get emails for the rest of the day talking about how I'm pushing my liberal agenda and that don't I understand that the Southern Poverty Law Center comes on radio programs like this so they can raise money by screaming about white males doing this kind of violence. What's your response?
Look, the fact of the matter is that is who are committing these acts of violence. I mean, you just look at the list of attacks coming from people who are either driven by hate ideas or radical anti-government beliefs, and the evidence stands for itself. Most of the terrorism that we've experienced domestically in the last couple, three decades has come from the extreme fringes of the right wing. Of course, that wasn't true in the 1960s when we had a lot of left wing violence. But those are just facts. And, you know, if the complaint is that we're making this up, I just say, look at the numbers.
All right. So how do we create a culture of vigilance about this where maybe we're more candid about race? I mean, I don't know. Maybe we watch guns more. And if I say the word gun, I'm going to get other kinds of emails that you can only imagine. How can we create vigilance about this that is on the order of utility as if you see something, say something? Do you have any insights there from all the work you've done?
Well, I think it's going to have to start with federal law enforcement. I mean, that's the appropriate body to be worrying about this. I mean, they are the ones who are supposed to be protecting us from this kind of stuff. So that's where it's got to start. Department of Homeland Security needs to do its job better. I will say this, Eric Holder did revive a task force of U.S. attorneys to deal with domestic terrorism. They've met three times since last June. That's a very good start. That task force was put into place after McVeigh blew up the Oklahoma City bombing. Obviously, he was influenced by hate ideas and anti-government ideas. And the last time it had met until Holder revived it, what it was supposed to meet was the day of the 9/11 attack. So I consider that a positive thing on this front.
Heidi, I asked a black legislator earlier today that if now a white person goes into a black church on Sunday, are all the blacks going to be afraid? And are all the African Americans going to be concerned about that? And he said, absolutely not. I think we should try that this weekend. Heidi, thanks so much.
That's a great idea. Yeah.
Heidi Byrick, head of the Intelligence Project at the Southern Poverty Law Center. And trust, that's the word. Hours after the shooting in Charleston, we reached out to poet Juan Felipe Herrera, the just-named poet laureate of the United States. And we found him right on the job, taking seriously his responsibility to, as he told us, use poetry and language to name history, even violent history in America.
You know, it's I've been thinking about it all morning. I've been scratching and scribbling about it and thinking about what I'm going to do as a U.S. poet laureate. And I want to include this whole thing about violence. I was thinking about it already, but I think it's hit all of us in the face once again, and it keeps on doing this. I think it's very sad. I think it's incredible. I think about what happens in our city and our society that kind of skews us, you know. It just bends us, and we do these things. I know there's individual choices, and it's not the city's fault, and it's not, you know, it's not A or B or C. But when we lack resources and we lack mental health services and we lack all those support systems that all of us need to be healthy and complete human beings, we will bend and break and do terrible, ugly things to others and to ourselves. Not to mention the kind of points of view that sometimes we gather from poisonous vines or poisonous sources, and we see that others of a different color, faith, or religion, or gender, or sexual orientation are people that we can mutilate, you know, and kill, even though it's wrong, you know. We go ahead and do it. So I feel, most of all, I feel a lot of compassion for those that have been hurt and those who are hurting. And I send my condolences and my love to them.
Juan Felipe Herrera's works are lyrics about the possibility of empathy from the perspective of a son of farm workers who grew up in poverty in a nation where people of different worlds seem to lack any emotional curiosity about others. Here is a part of Herrera's poem, Song Out There.
Can you turn around so I can look into your eyes? Just for once, your eyes, maybe like hers. Can you see her? And his. Can you see them? I want you to see them.
You can listen to our full interview with poet laureate Juan Felipe Herrera on the Takeaway Weekender. You're listening to the Takeaway Podcast. I'm John Hockenberry. Here's a quick appeal. The more subscribers we have, the easier it is for us to attract the sponsors to keep our show going. So if you like the program, please let folks know. A Facebook like or a follow on Twitter means so much. Thanks again for downloading this podcast, which is brought to you by the fine folks at WNYC and Public Radio International.
Dad, are any of these movies good?
Worst episode ever.
I see a lot of films. I love all of them.
Your job is to rate movies on a scale from good to excellent.
Hated it.
Oh, goody, it's Friday. That means we get to talk about movies with Kristen Meinzer, culture producer for The Takeaway and co-host of the Movie Date podcast. With her weekly date, Rafer Guzman, film critic for Newsday and co-host of the Movie Date podcast. Hi, you guys. I'm very jealous.
Hey, John.
Hey, John.
Jealous of what?
You have seen Inside Out. I have not seen Inside Out.
Indeed.
That's the big Pixar movie.
Today's your chance.
It's safe to come out of the house weekend in the movies. There's no dinosaurs. There's no earthquakes. I mean, they're still
right
in the theaters, but that's not the premiere. Let's start with Inside Out, Pixar movie. Let's hear a clip.
Riley, if you don't eat your dinner, you're not going to get any dessert.
Wait, did he just say we couldn't have dessert?
That's anger. Cares very deeply about things being fair.
So that's how you want to play it, old man? No dessert? Oh, sure. We'll eat our dinner right after you eat this. Ah!
Louis Black and Amy Poehler having an enormous amount of fun, it would seem. Sketch out the premise here, Raver.
Well, you've basically got two emotions there. It's Amy Poehler as joy, Louis Black as sadness.
Anger.
Okay.
Thank you.
Start over again.
Kristen, you get it. Kristen is always better with the premises.
But no, this is exactly what is happening in the head. They're always confusing each other, getting mad at each other, trying to outwit each other about whose emotions can override the other emotions inside of Riley. Riley's a little 10-year-old girl who's going through some major changes in her family life right now. They just relocated from Minnesota to San Francisco, and she's trying to be a happy girl, but she's very, very sad underneath it all, and we watch these emotions fighting it out.
To be precise, this is a movie that takes place in the mind of little Riley.
Yes, this is all in her mind. And you know what? I have to just say hats off to the girl who plays Sadness, this actress named Phyllis Smith. She's really terrific. She's really terrific. And the movie is very smart in some ways. The logic's confusing in others where I didn't quite know what was happening. But all in all, I still enjoyed it and I cried, which is a huge thing for me when I cry.
A.L. Scott said, kids who see this with their parents will be very disturbed by the fact that their parents will be crying during the last 20 minutes of the film. Rafer, what did you think?
I mean, I was really suspicious of this film when the trailers came out because I kept thinking, well, how are we supposed to get involved with emotions? Emotions aren't really real. What's going to happen to an emotion inside a girl's head?
And you're a guy, so it's hard.
And I'm a guy. I completely agree. Not my territory, but... I just thought this film was marvelous. It's such a brilliant, brilliant idea, taking this extended metaphor, finding a way to make it work inside and also outside of the girl. You also get to see what's happening to her, her reactions, how she's dealing with life, what's happening to her in your school. I just thought this was like one of the best films I've seen in a long time. Wow. And probably one of the best Pixar films I've ever seen. It's fantastic.
I suspect that if this metaphor catches on, there's going to be a lot of changes in the language as some of the little one-liners of these characters work their way into sort of kid discussions. But number two movie, let's move on, Dope.
Allow me to introduce myself. My name is Malcolm Adekambi. I'm a straight-A student with nearly perfect SAT scores.
I play in a punk band with my friends, and I'm a 90s hip-hop geek. A bad day for most geeks would be being the butt of jokes. But when you live in the bottoms, a bad day could look like this.
Now, that's pretty much the premise of this movie, a bad neighborhood, but a geeky kid. How does it work, Kristen?
This is so original. This is so fun. This is so on point with contemporary America today. This is one of the best teen comedies I've ever seen.
I agree. It's a lot of fun. It is essentially just sort of a rowdy teen comedy, but the conversations about race and identity are what really make it fresh. And it's got some very funny, smart moments to it. I really enjoyed it a lot.
There are millions of people out there right now making plans to go to the movies because of those two raves. Thanks, guys. What's on the podcast, Kristen?
Well, for this week's movie therapy question, we have a listener who's sad that her dad is no longer around, and we're going to prescribe some movies to watch.
Are you licensed to do that?
We are non-licensed.
Only in our minds.
Therapy Without a License from Kristen Meinzer, culture producer for The Takeaway and co-host of the Movie Date podcast with Rafer Guzman, who's also film critic for Newsday. Have a great weekend, guys.
You too, John.
One, two, three, four, five. Break down, baby.
It's time for the Friday Five. And if you don't know what the Friday Five is, each Friday we choose a theme. Sean Ramaswamy comes in and says, forget the theme, so we cross it out. And what we do is have Sean go through the internet and find five wonderful things that you might have missed. He's a producer with Studio 360, host of the incredible podcast Sideshow.
And edible now available in digestible form.
All right. First thing?
Jeb's running for president. He's got a great new logo, and the internet's favorite part was the exclamation point at the end. The logo is simply J-E-B in bubble letters, exclamation point in bubble exclamation point. And the internet immediately had a lot of fun with it, as it should. They turned it into, like, the exclamation punch for Adam West's Batman. Like, Jeb! And they made it a logo for puppy treats, like Jeb. They made it into the new logo for a terrible-looking Kevin James comedy, just to select a few.
Sworn oath to protect this mall and all inside it.
You can check him out at thetakeaway.org.
Cha-ching. All right, number two.
There's this podcast called Serial.
Yeah.
It was good business for all podcasts, that one. And I think something's about to happen that's also going to be good business for podcasts. This week, Marc Maron released an episode of his immensely popular WTF podcast featuring Judd Apatow. But before he got to Judd, he made a big announcement, and I brought a clip.
If everything goes as planned, I will post a WTF, an episode of this show that you're listening to now.
He takes a while.
Featuring myself in conversation with, talking to, at my home in my garage.
Yeah, we get it, Mark.
Me talking to the president of the United States of America, Barack Obama.
That's cool, though. At least there's a payoff.
I guess the dogs are sniffing his garage right
now. He's trying to build suspense at a garage. It's hard. But he did it.
You think it's actually happening?
I think it's going to happen today, and he's going to release it on Monday. I mean, for podcasting, it's huge, John.
Three.
Terry Gross is not happy. Number three, Chris Pratt. He's in the new Jurassic Park movie. Did you see it?
No.
Me neither yet, but I will.
Yet.
There's a lot of bad news on the internet this week, of course, but thankfully there was Pratt-keeping to cheer us up. It's a new meme based on an image of Chris Pratt attempting to direct a pack of velociraptors in the new Jurassic Park movie, Jurassic World. There's a poster of him like holding his arms up, outstretched. And this has become a meme. Local zookeepers across the country are posting photos of them with their two arms outstretched directing animals. But instead of velociraptors, you've got like little chickens and flamingos and penguins and giraffes and hippopotami. And it's hilarious.
You can relate to at least one of those things, right?
Number four.
Number four. Vin Diesel is one of the best things on the internet. Did you know?
It don't matter if you win by an inch or a mile. Winning's winning.
Well, I suppose.
Just because he's so weird, all he does on... First of all, he is an industry, not only in film where he's been on Guardians of the Galaxy and Fast and Furious movies and is huge, but on Facebook. And this week, I think he peaked. I brought some music to set the scene here. It's him outside of his car window, filming a video of himself as the car drives down some Moroccan-looking street, and he's just staring into his camera, smiling as he passes palm trees and sort of stucco houses. And then at the end, he leaves us a message, and here's the message.
I can't tell you how blessed I am to have such an incredible community here.
I can't tell you how blessed I am
to have such an incredible community here. He's talking about on Facebook. The caption of the video is experiment, make product, lead with love. I think Vin Diesel is maybe one of the better things about the internet because he's one of the hardest things to understand. And I just wanted to share that with you, John. I'm sorry.
Number five.
Number five, you know, the Teletubbies?
Yeah.
Someone took some footage of the Teletubbies rolling down hills and filtered it black and white and said it's a Joy Division's atmosphere. And it's like 4 minutes of just beautiful, surreal footage. And you have to watch it. It's a mashup video that really works for some reason that I can't explain.
But works in the sense that it calms you down?
Yeah. You'd think it'd be unsettling, but it's actually really, really calming and beautiful. Just imagine Teletubbies in black and white rolling down hills now, okay?
Ah.
Into your weekend.
Ah.
Soothe.
Ah.
But let's go forward into the weekend. Sean Ramaswamy, thanks so much. What's on the podcast?
A guy who turned his Twitter account into a Broadway show. Pretty impressive.
Oh, nice.
Yeah.
That's the podcast called Sideshow.
Correct. Now edible.
Now edible. Sean Ramaswamy, Studio 360 producer. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Support for The Takeaway comes from Curious.com, committed to helping people learn more than 15,000 skills like Hungarian, hula hooping, and HTML. Curious.com. Grow your skills. Learn more at Curious.com/PRI.
In a very tense scene in the astronaut movie The Right Stuff, Mrs. Gus Grissom, wife of the Mercury astronaut, suddenly realizes that she isn't going to get a personal thank you from the President of the United States or the First Lady after her husband went up in space.
Oh, all those years of test flying, and all those times I waited, and all those times that you weren't there. The military promised. Look, I am finally Mrs. Honorable Astronaut, but they are treating me like I'm Honorable Mrs. Squirmin' Hatch Blower.
I did not do anything wrong! The hatch just blew. It was a glitch. It was a technical malfunction. Why in hell would anyone believe me?
They owe you.
What did the space program and the military owe the astronauts from Mercury, Gemini, Apollo, and beyond? What was owed to the wives of those astronauts, the families on the front lines of America's national mission back in the 1960s? That bit of untold history is the subject of a new ABC series that premiered last night. It's called The Astronaut Wives Club.
You promised the press a comment. Louise. Louise.
Alan can never know I was scared. No one can.
The series comes from a book by former New York Times journalist Lily Coppell, who interviewed all of the real first ladies of space to write her fictionalized account. Coppell dropped herself into a world of 60s fashions and hokey housewife stand-by-your-man morality and tough women orbiting around some very special mad men space travelers, women who were happy to give Lily Coppell a piece of their mind about what they had endured way back when, even Mrs. Gus Grissom.
That was sort of the wives' prize early on in the Mercury program, that they were going to go to the White House, you know, to Camelot and meet Jackie. And Betty was one of the first wives I actually sat down with in Houston and got to interview. And I asked her about that moment, and she, you know, she remembered it.
I bet. And that's just a tip of the iceberg of the kind of humiliation and very backseat that these women had to quietly sit in while their husbands both risked their lives and were gone most of the time.
Well, they were in the back seat sort of emotionally because they weren't able to show the incredible roller coaster ride that they were going through. They felt that they had to act, as one of the wives put it. She came up with a motto for them. This was Reen Carpenter, who was blonde and vivacious. She was sort of the opposite of Betty, who was more of the country mouse Hoosier, who had a very hard time with the press. But she said, happy, proud, and thrilled. That's what America demanded of these women, because going into space wasn't only about beating the Soviets. It was also a propaganda mission, and it was outer space, apple pie, baseball, and the women had to be that perfect specimen of an American housewife, you know, when it was its hardest, I think, to fulfill back then.
Great fashions in this show, that's for sure. And as I was looking at old clips of the right stuff, you know, all those wives dressed up like Jackie, and you know, it really just teleports you right back to the early 60s.
Oh, absolutely it is. I mean, what's so amazing is that for 50 years, no one told this story. And when I first started interviewing the women, and they're scattered around the country like moon rocks, I interviewed over 30 of them for the book and would go into their homes. I was sitting across from Joe Shura, who was married to Wally, one of the Mercury astronauts. And I said, Joe, with you know, Norman Mailer, with Tom Wolfe coming into your homes, sitting in your living rooms, interviewing your husbands, how was the wives' story never written? And she said, we would go and hide. It was sort of a joke, but it also rang true. The women felt acutely the pressure. If they said anything that reflected badly on their husbands, that they might miss a space flight. During the Gemini program, Marilyn Lovell, who's married to Jim Lovell, who, of course, everyone knows from the Tom Hanks movie in Apollo 13, she was pregnant when Jim was about to get named for a Gemini flight, and she actually hid her pregnancy from her husband for several months. And when he finally found out and asked her if she was pregnant, yes, she said. And she said, you know, sorry, I thought that if, you know, NASA found out, you might not get the flight. And he said, good idea. Let's keep it under wraps for a little longer.
Oh, God, you are the perfect person to ask a question I've always wanted to ask. You may know the answer to this. That scene in Apollo 13 where she loses her wedding ring in the shower, is that true?
It is true.
Really?
Yes. And Marilyn sort of reenacted the whole story as I was sitting across from her in her Lake Forest home. I'm also from Chicago, and Marilyn and I had a wonderful rapport. But that is true. And many of those moments in the movie are, Marilyn said to me, she just felt like she was in a shell during that whole mission. She felt so acutely that she had to protect her family from the media. The women really were like America's first reality stars. They are military wives. They were living ordinary lives before their husbands become astronauts. But all of a sudden, their lives are completely turned inside out. And so they were really unusual in that they tried to keep their families very down to earth, even when there were the media circus out on the lawn constantly. But Marilyn said it wasn't until Jim splashed down and the Nixons flew the wives out on Air Force One to go meet their husbands in the Pacific that she realized that the whole world had sort of been praying with her.
You asked the question of some of these astronaut wives. Tom Wolfe interviewed you. Norman Mailer interviewed you. How come the story of the women didn't come out? As you were asking that question, as you were repeating that, I thought to myself, yeah, Tom Wolfe and Norman Mailer, you have your answer. Particularly
right.
Mailer.
Yeah, you know, the women were sort of like a little garnish of parsley here and there. But, you know, that's what made it so much fun to tell this story, to completely invert sort of the history. And here we have this big slice of American history pie that was somehow left out. there were just so many wonderful things about this story in the world. Like, all of the families lived in the space burbs in Houston outside of NASA's operations, and journalists at the time called it Togethersville. It was almost something like out of the Stepford Wives. And Annie and John Glenn lived next to Reen and Scott Carpenter. And Betty and Gus Grissom lived next to Joe and Wally Schura, a little Jetson swath of Texas, you know. And it was big hair and big ambitions. And also just sort of the unique loneliness of going into space. I mean, the men had their sort of spiritual transformations, and then what the women were going through back at home. They were essentially single mothers during the week. As soon as their husbands were named astronauts, they become sort of human supermen, literally, and they're spending their weeks at Cape Canaveral and flying these hot T-38s that are sort of Corvettes of the sky between the Houston space burbs in Florida. Many of them were leading sort of second lives.
Lily Coppell is author of The Astronaut Wives Club. The ABC series premiered last night. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
I'm a military spouse, and I give up a lot for my husband's career because that's just what you do as a military wife. I spent 3 years alone while he was deployed to Japan, but now he's home. Yay!
Astronaut sacrifices, military wife sacrifices, Salt Lake City, Utah. My wife is a special effects makeup artist. I have on several occasions filled in as her model for body paint or casting molds for prosthetic crafting. I generally spend hours shaving my body, followed by a long day of staying very still. Hey, if that's your secret and you're staying together, more power to you. That's all for today. You can respond to anything you heard on today's program. Just call us at 8778-MY-TAKE or comment at thetakeaway.org. And folks, thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
Support for The Takeaway comes from the Henry Luce Foundation. For increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia, and the Rockefeller Foundation, whose transportation initiative is promoting equitable and sustainable developments in communities across the country.
PRI, Public Radio International.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, the New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for the New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.